If your credit card bills have gotten out of hand, call Consolidated Credit now. If you're making the minimum payments, but your balance is just not going down, call Consolidated Credit now. If the interest rates on your credit cards are so high, it would take years to get out of debt, call Consolidated Credit now. They've helped over 5 million people with credit card debt. They can consolidate your debts into one lower payment, reduce your interest rates, and get you out of debt fast. If you're struggling with credit card debt, the first step is yours. Call Consolidated Credit now. Call 800-463-1749. 800-463-1749. That's 800-463-1749. Consolidated Credit Counseling Services Incorporated, 5701 West Sunrise Boulevard, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 33313. Not a loan company. Licensed by the New York Department of Financial Services and by the Vermont Department of Financial Regulation. Maryland DM-19, Oregon DM-80031. Licensed by the Virginia State Corporation Commission. License number DC-32.
From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports.
Murder in Greenwich, home of our flagship station. A murder that's captivated a nation over 40 years. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. puts his reputation on the line for his cousin, Michael Skakel, proclaiming his innocence, charging he was framed, claiming he can ID the real killers. The Martha Moxley murder today on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a New York Times bestselling author, one of the nation's leading environmental activists. He's president of the Waterkeeper Alliance, the world's largest clean water advocacy group, a professor of environmental litigation at Pace University here in White Plains, senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council, former assistant DA in Manhattan, of course, a member of America's most prominent political family. He's got a controversial book that's just out, Framed, Why Michael Skakel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit. Thanks, Bobby, and thanks for being in studio with us, too.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
By the way, just to remind folks, Martha Moxley was murdered in 1975 on Halloween Eve. Michael Skakel was convicted of that. He served 11 and a half years before a habeas corpus appeal let him out for incompetent legal representation by Mickey Sherman, also a Greenwich resident. Let me ask you first, because this is what folks have asked me, prominent family, leading environmentalist, why are you risking your reputation? Why are you doing this?
Well, I wrote the book because the same reason that I wrote the article, my Atlantic Monthly article in 2003, because I knew Michael Skakel was innocent. Oddly, my relationship with Michael Skakel over the past, since 2003, has been largely estranged. In fact, I didn't reconcile with him until January of this year. But I knew he was innocent, and I watched this whole trial happen, and it was like watching a slow-motion train wreck. I didn't know about the corruption that I found while investigating this book. I didn't know about a lot of the details, but I could tell, I knew from watching it that he was being railroaded.
The title is Framed, and ironically, Michael was never a suspect until he put himself at the scene of the crime in the Sutton Report, which, for those that don't know, was a private investigation group hired by Michael's father to look into this thing, to hopefully exonerate them. And he would never have been a suspect if he hadn't put himself there.
Michael is, that's right, but he was telling the truth. You know, Michael doesn't have a good filter. He's not a strategic thinker. Whatever comes into his head, he talks about, and he was... And by the time the Sutton report came out, he'd been sober for a decade. He's scrupulously honest. And when they asked him what had really happened that night, he gave a different story than he'd told police in 1975. But it was not a new story. He'd been telling that story ever since he got sober in 1982.
Now, I got to commend you on this. First of all, obviously, great loyalty. The book is incredibly detailed. For my looking at this, I said, well, I'm going to go look at some of the stuff that you used and that's out there, the Sutton Report, which we just talked about what that is, the Furman book. I looked at Martha's diary a little bit. the YouTube that you recommended on Tony Bryant and the Atlantic Monthly article that you wrote, and then obviously framed. First off, on the Atlantic Monthly article, that was obviously focused on Kenneth Littleton, who was the tutor, extensively. In your book here, he has almost a bulletproof alibi with Tommy Skakel. The sexual encounter ended at 9:50 between Martha and Tommy. He then watched the French Connection either at 10 or 10:17. He arrived. That means that Littleton had that little window to go out, pick up a golf club, and rage kill someone he didn't know because he had just moved in that night. What about the sort of the changes in even your approach?
When I wrote the Atlantic Monthly article in 2003, I was very careful about saying, I don't know that Kenny Littleton committed this crime, but I know that the evidence against him was far stronger than any evidence against Michael Skakel. Michael Skakel could not have committed the crime. He was 11 miles away with five eyewitnesses when the crime was committed. There were eight eyewitnesses that remained at home at Belhaven who either saw him left or saw him leave, saw him come back, and all of them have testified through the years that he was not at the house at that time. Kenny Littleton, on the other hand, had five separate alibis. Every time he talked to police, his alibis changed dramatically. He failed lie detector tests on multiple occasions. He was linked by police to 20 other serial killings, mainly of young blonde girls Martha's age in Canada and the United States and different places where he'd lived. And he was in and out of prisons and mental hospitals, and he made several statements that appeared to be confessions to the crime. So it was a very strong case against him. I don't believe that Kenny Littleton committed the crime. And I said at the time that I didn't know because I don't think the evidence was sufficient. I think it pointed to him in many ways, and he was by far the strongest suspect. And he was the primary suspect of the police who were investigating this for 25 years.
I want to talk about that alibi about going to the backcountry a little bit later. To me, I looked at a framework, too. Could you establish reasonable doubt legally? And I think that's not actually, honestly, very hard to do going beyond Tommy Skakel. And why is it that you don't list him as a logical suspect?
Oh, well, I do in this book.
Not anywhere near your killer, in terms of priorities and how you list them out.
Each one of the suspects I devote a chapter to, and Tommy has the longest chapter. Tommy Skakel didn't commit this crime. His alibi is it's ironclad. It's not, Michael's is the strongest alibi, but Jonathan Benedict, who's the prosecutor in this case, and Detective Frank Garr, who had a great antipathy, hates the Skakels, and spent a lot of his career trying to link the Skakels to this crime, but even he says that Tommy Skakel could not possibly have committed this crime. And the reason he gives is the same reason that you described for Kenny Littleton, that he's a 17-year-old kid. He would have had to murder Martha. The murder took place at 10 o'clock at night. And Tommy, 20 minutes later, was watching The French Connection.
He also has no motive.
He has no motive, exactly. But, whoever committed this crime was covered with blood. He was wearing the same clothes that he wore at dinner. That fact is attested to by Kenny Littleton, who was the principal suspect, and it would have a great incentive to inculpate Tommy.
I agree.
On the other hand, Tommy really doesn't alibi Kenny Littleton, because Tommy says that when they were watching The French Connection, Kenny Littleton kept himself draped in a blanket the whole time, and that blanket could have been used. And it was odd because it was hot. It was warm inside the room.
It's just hard to conceive that.
It's hard to conceive.
He moves in, he doesn't even know her. But,
yeah, exactly.
Let me ask you, on the Sutton report, they identify a profile of the killer. That profile fits Michael the best, 14 to 18, walking distance of the victim, same socioeconomic, strong sibling rivalries, behavioral problems in school, sexually immature, which you say in the book, by the way, under the influence of alcohol. And they describe Michael as severely agitated, possibly of psychotic proportions. He had a very abusive background. I happen to, Tommy Reynolds is great friends with my parents. Ann Reynolds Skakel was the mother. When she died, the family basically fell apart. I feel bad for Michael in that sense. But the Sutton report, basically profile and fit, he's the best fit from there.
There's a number of problems with that theory. One is that Michael couldn't have committed the crime because he was 11 miles away with all the eyewitnesses. Nobody's ever been able to explain how he could have committed this crime from 11 miles away.
If he went to the backcountry.
If he went to the backcountry, and if he didn't go to the backcountry, and why, then why did nobody see him the entire night?
Well, hypothetically, Bobby,
you would have had you need 15 people essentially to be lying to say that he didn't go to the backcountry, including people who have no relationship to the Skakel family. The other thing is that the Sutton report is not reliable because, as I show in the book, and this is one of the things we discovered in writing the book, is that Tommy Sheridan, who was an insider in the Skakel family, who dreamed up the Sutton report, then subtly manipulated the contents of the Sutton report to implicate Michael. So it was the whole exercise of the Sutton report was deliberately orchestrated in order to falsely implicate Michael.
Sheridan comes off very badly in your book, although he says that Michael didn't do it.
He says that Michael, but if you read, he was saying to people's faces that Michael didn't do it, but he was saying behind the Skakel's backs, hey, you should keep looking at Michael. And
all right, you're listening to Biz Talk Radio Network, Biz Talk with Jim Campbell over the Biz Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. We'll ask Bobby Kennedy who he's uncovered next.
U2 America TV, featuring original live programs created with you in mind. Engage with shows through social media and the U2 America app. America Trends with Dr. Gina covers the trending topics of the day and allows viewers to interact with the show. Sully's Biz Brew is business with a barroom slant, delivered with a twist. Visit U2America.com to find a channel near you. U2 America, red, white, and you.
Have you heard? Proactive Plus is faster and better than ever. Stay tuned for a million bottle giveaway, and you'll also receive free shipping. Do you have troubled skin, acne? Well, we have great news. With Proactive Plus, your acne can heal, and you can help prevent new breakouts from happening. Don't miss this limited-time offer. Give us a call at 800-726-1031 because we're going to let a million people try Proactive Plus risk-free and get two free gifts and also receive free shipping when you call right now. You heard it. This offer won't last long. So call Proactive Plus now and you'll receive a 60-day risk-free trial of Proactive Plus, two free extras, and free shipping. Call 800-726-1031. This is our exclusive radio offer, never on TV. Get your risk-free 60-day trial of Proactive Plus with free shipping. That's right, free shipping. Don't wait. Call 800-726-1031. That's 800-726-1031.
Hey, Bob, how's business? Is the new website helping?
Not good. I can't figure out how to get the website finished. How did you do it?
Easy. I called web.com. They built my website for free. Then they promoted it on all the search engines.
Like Google, Yahoo, and Bing?
Exactly. And web.com has helped grow my business so much, I had to bring on new staff.
Call now, 1-800-535-9652. That's 1-800-535-9652.
There is no upfront charge for building the website, after which the ongoing fee applies. Rights to the website are relinquished upon cancellation unless otherwise purchased.
Here's George Foreman with InventHelp.
Hi, I'm George Foreman. Do you have an idea for a new product or invention? People ask me all the time, George, how do I get my idea in front of companies? How do I get a patent? What do I do next? Do you have the same questions? I'll tell you like I'll tell them all. Call my friends at InventHelp.
Call InventHelp today for free information. InventHelp has been helping inventors for more than 30 years and has sales offices nationwide. InventHelp can submit your invention to companies who are interested in receiving new new ideas. If you have an idea and want to try to patent it and submit it to companies, you should call InventHelp today for free information.
Listen, I can't guarantee a company will be interested in your idea, but I believe every inventor deserves the opportunity to step into the ring and take their best shot. Put InventHelp in your corner.
To get your free inventor's information, call 1-800-351-1453. That's 1-800-351-1453. Again, 1-800-351-1453.
Are you ready to leave your corporate job behind and be your own boss? Have you ever dreamed of owning a business? Do you have $50,000 or more sitting around in a 401k? If you answered yes, it's time to invest in yourself by buying or starting a business or franchise. IRS code allows you to use money in a 401k to invest in a business with absolutely no penalties or taxes. At Guidant Financial, we've helped more than 11,000 entrepreneurs invest $3 billion in retirement assets into the small businesses and franchises of their dreams. So if you've got $50,000 or more in a 401k and you're looking for a way to start a business, call Guidant Financial now for free information and to learn more. Operators are standing by for your call. 800-570-6630. 800-570-6630. 800-570-6630. That's 800-570-6630.
BizTalkRadio.com.
And we're back talking with Bobby Kennedy about his belief his cousin Michael Skakel was framed for the murder of Martha Moxley in 1975. The ending is, I think, incredibly powerful, put together. Who done it? Let me ask you, you mentioned estrangement between you and Michael. Michael's done a lot of good works for the last X number of years. Even the judge had said that when he sentenced him. Why has Michael and Tommy not spoken in 20 years? Is Tommy bitter that he was the suspect?
Tommy actually would like to reconcile with Michael. So, but Michael, you know, Michael, I believe, will reconcile with Tommy at some point. Michael, first of all, has been in jail for 11 years. And he had a very little contact with the outside world. He only saw his son 8 times. I think that reconciliation has not taken place. Michael has a really strong AA program. He's been sober for 35 years. And, you know, one of the things that program teaches is you can't, you know, you have to reconcile your relationships, and I think he's going to do that.
So he knows that that should be on his agenda.
Well, let me talk to you about how I kind of stumbled onto this story. I wrote in 2003 when Michael was convicted. It shocked the Skakel family, and it shocked me personally. Nobody believed that he would ever be convicted of this, and I wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly that detailed how Michael could not have committed the crime. The article won a number of prizes, but in addition to that, I received a note shortly after its publication from a man I'd never heard of called Crawford Mills, who was a classmate of Michael Skakel's at Brunswick School in Greenwich. Crawford Mills opened with a provocative line. He said the jury got it wrong. And then he outlined this extraordinary story that he knew who actually killed Martha Moxley, and that a person who had informed him of this was another classmate, Tony Bryant. Tony Bryant is a member of a very prominent African-American family in New York. His cousin is Kobe Bryant, the Lakers star. His brother played in the NBA also for the Mavericks. His mother is an Oscar-winning film producer. He was part of an integration push at Brunswick School in 1973 and 1974, along with one other African-American student. He was a star athlete. He was not a friend of Michael Skakel's. In 1975, in his junior year, he moved back to New York to be with his mother, and he enrolled in a public school in New York called the Charles Evan Hughes High School. That fall, he befriended two boys who committed the crime. The boys, he knew the boys as Adolph and Burr. They were large kids. They were a year older than their classmates. They were 6'3" and 6'4", respectively. Each of them weighed around 250 pounds, and they were both very powerful athletes who were capable of committing a crime that required this the kind of savagery that Martha Moxley's murder entailed. Tony brought them up to Greenwich on about six occasions to hang out with his old pals in Greenwich. On one of those occasions, they met, the two boys met Martha Moxley, and this is recorded in her diary that she was at the, Tony brought them to a Sacred Heart mixer in Greenwich to a dance, and Martha describes that that evening also in her diary. And Adolf Hasbrook, one of the two boys, became obsessed with Martha at that dance, and for the next 2 months could talk about nothing else except for his fixation for Martha. On Halloween Eve, they came back to Greenwich to participate in Hell Night or Mischief Night, which was a big celebration in Greenwich where people, kids, wanted the town committing acts of vandalism. They went up. They arrived. They planned the sexual assault on the train on the way up, the two boys. They told Tony that they were going to get a Greenwich girl caveman style, which meant, according to Tony, hit her over the head with a club, drag her into the bushes by her hair, and then sexually assault her. When they got to Greenwich, they wandered around throwing eggs, throwing rocks at cars, soaping people's windows, hiding behind bushes, hiding behind stone walls to avoid detection. It was a cold night. It was very dark. They eventually ended up at 8:45 that evening on the Skakel's back lawn on the chipping tee that Rush Skakel maintained, Michael's father maintained for his house guests and for his family. They picked up three golf clubs on the chipping tee, three Skakel golf clubs that were strewn there from a Mitsubishi chipping tournament that Rush Skakel had hosted a few weeks before. The two boys told Tony, now we have our caveman clubs, and Tony got nervous and threw his club away and went home, made his way back to the Greenwich train station 20 minutes before the murder was committed. The two boys then watched Tommy Skakel making out with Martha in the back of the tool shed, which was visible to them, but they were not visible because of the ambient light from the house. They could be seen. Tommy and Martha could be seen, but the boys could not be seen from an area that is known as the Mead, where kids hit. They assaulted Martha Moxley on her way home and then hid out that night in the home of an 11-year-old boy called Jeffrey Byrne, who was a mutual friend of Crawford Mills and Tony Bryan and Michael Skakel, and who was a neighbor of Michael Skakel's. The following Monday, that was a Thursday night, the following Monday, Tony met them for the first time again at school, and they confessed to him that they had gotten their caveman, that they had, in other words, committed the murder. And over the next 2 months, they added many details to that made it very clear that they had killed Martha Moxley. In addition to that, Jeffrey Byrne, the 11-year-old boy, made many trips down to New York City from Greenwich by himself on the train because he was so traumatized by what had happened that night. And he was angry at Tony for getting him involved with these boys, and he warned Tony, they're bad. You need to stay away from them. Tony confessed, told his mother what had happened. His mother recognized the racial landscapes at this time. It was 1975, and that the Greenwich police were notoriously racist, that Tony had placed himself a few feet from the murder scene with a golf club in his hands 20 minutes before the murder, that he was black, and she warned him that he could be implicated in this crime if he confessed, and that he had brought the murderers to Greenwich. She said he had to keep his mouth shut and that he had to separate himself from his two friends. He did that. She sent him away to Texas to boarding school to get him out of New York City, away from these kids, and he didn't talk about it for almost three decades. When I finally reached him on the phone, I said to him, I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Michael Skakel's my cousin. I'd like to ask you about Martha Moxley's murder. And there was dead silence on the end of the line. And then he said, after about 5 seconds, he said, I've been waiting 27 years for this phone call.
All right, we'll talk about this and other alibis. We'll look at some of the evidence with Bobby Kennedy on the Martha Moxley murder coming up next.
Do you have an old car sitting in your driveway? How would you like to learn a hassle-free way to get rid of it, help kids in need, and get a great tax donation in the process? It's real easy. One simple free call to our car donation hotline is all it takes. Call the Neshama Foundation at 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. We'll come pick your car up for free and give you a tax donation for the full value of the car, running or not. The value of your unwanted car will go to help kids in need. It's fast and easy. Just call us and your car will be gone and on its way to helping children in 48 hours. And you get a nice tax deduction. Call the Neshama Foundation now to get rid of your car, help kids, and get a tax write-off.
Call 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. That's 800-721-6723.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world. And they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that may allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. U.S. Tax Shield offers a price protection guaranteed quote to get you protected today. U.S. Tax Shield is A-plus rated with the Better Business Bureau, so call now. 800-658-3876. That's 800-658-3876. U.S. Tax Shield. 800-658-3876.
Have you written a book and want to get it published? Then call Page Publishing ASAP. We're looking for authors of all types of books. And unlike most publishers, Page Publishing will take the time to review each and every book submitted to us. And we'll give you our feedback. And if we like what we read, we will get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, the Apple iTunes Store, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. We handle everything. Editing, cover design, copyright protection, printing, publicity, and distribution. So if you've written a novel, children's book, cookbook, inspirational work, poetry, or a biography and want to get it published, call Page Publishing now for your free author submission kit. Your road to fame and fortune could very well start with this simple phone call.
888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. That's 888-785-0618.
This alert just came in. This special announcement is for business owners and leaders of organizations who've been waiting for the right time to build. General Steel has made it impossible to wait any longer with rock-bottom prices that could save you thousands. That's right, General Steel, America's leader in pre-engineered structures, is offering buildings at prices you will never see again. Don't miss these prices, a 50 by 100 for under $30,000. You heard right, that's 5,000 square feet under $30,000. Manufacturers, if you need a larger building, try a 100 by 100 commercial building for $129,000. You can't afford to rent with these prices. Imagine a 70 by 100 foot church building for under $69,000. With the economy improving and interest rates still at historic lows, you can't afford to wait.
Call 800-605-5370, 800-605-5370. Call 800-605-5370. 605-5370.
How deep in debt are you? $10,000? $15,000? Maybe even more? And every day that goes by, you know what happens. Your debt gets larger and larger and larger. Well, if you've had it with your mushrooming debt problem and the stress it is causing you, make this free call today to the Debt Solutions Network. One quick, no-obligation call is all it takes for one of our partner companies to show you how they can help you get out of debt. So if you have $10,000 or more in combined debt and you want to learn how you can solve it, make this free, no-obligation call now.
800-814-5035. 800-814-5035.
If you are in serious debt, you have to get out of it and fast. Call my friends at the Debt Solutions Network now.
800-814-5035. 800-814-5035. Call us 24/7. 800-814-5035.
BizTalkRadio.com.
And we're back with Bobby Kennedy on his controversial new book, Framed, Why Michael Skakel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit. All right, we were talking about Tony Bryan and his claims and who you think were the real killers. And you got a few more comments you want to finish up with?
Well, you know, my initial reaction to Tony Bryan was that I believed his account, but I needed to verify it. He only knew the first names of the two men he said killed Martha Moxie, which was Adolph and Burr. I was able to track down a yearbook from the Charles Evan Hughes High School and determined that Adolph was Adolph Hasbrook of Bridgeport, Connecticut, that Burr was Burton Tinsley of Portland, Oregon. I called both of them and had conversations and tape recorded those conversations, and they admitted all of the important particulars. Of course, they didn't admit to killing Martha Moxley, but they admitted knowing Tony Bryant, knowing Crawford Mills, hanging out in Greenwich with Tony Bryant. They admitted knowing Jeffrey Byrne and the house that they spent the night and cleaned off the blood. Afterwards, they described the interior of that house with details that nobody else could have known, right down to the brand of the refrigerator in Jeffrey Byrne's kitchen. They then, after some time, after several conversations, they began dissembling and then later denied that they had been at Greenwich that night. They both said they had looked at their diaries from 28 years before and that they had been mistaken and were not in Greenwich that night after all. And then when we subpoenaed them, they took the Fifth Amendment. But I found in my investigation mountains of corroborative evidence to support Tony's stories, including the fact that there were two hairs that were taken off of Martha's body or from the blanket that on which she was placed. And one of those hairs was identified by the FBI crime lab as being Negroid, and nobody has ever been able to explain that. The other hair was described as being having Asian characteristics, and Tony Bryant describes Burton Tinsley as Caucasian but with American Indian blood or Asian blood, so that would be consistent with that description. There's a lot of other corroborative evidence as well that's in the book.
Okay, Bobby. I did watch, per your recommendation, the book that Vito Colucci interrogating Tony Bryant. He comes off looking very articulate and sincere. But no one saw these two guys that night. Helen Nicks didn't see him. He says in the tape that Margie Walker, who was, I guess, Neil Walker's sister who lived next door, saw him, that he talked to them. She didn't even go out that night. Another person named Lisa Rader Edwards said she didn't go out that night. And I've been in Belhaven, as I was telling you. These folks, like black folk, would have really stuck out back then. But the security guards on the booth actually come to recognize you. Used to drop my daughter every day. They would wave. No one saw the guy, and in the 07 attempt at the retrial, why has it never been considered credible enough to be entered as evidence anywhere?
Here's the answer. Those are two questions. The first question is that the question of whether they were there that night. And, you know, the best evidence that they were is that Tony Bryant, who is also African-American, says he was there, and it's definitely not in his interest to admit that he was there. Both of the men, Adolph and Burr, both acknowledged on tape that they were there that night and that they were there many times in the past. You know, one of the issues with this book is that people's memories 30 years later are incomplete. You said that Margie Walker says she wasn't out that night, but Burton and Tinsley and Tony said that they dropped by her house and that she wasn't out that night.
But wouldn't she have said she saw them then?
Well, if she remembered, but, you know, the memories of that night are incomplete. And, everybody says, well, a black person in Greenwich would have been noticed, but there was a lot of black people in Greenwich that time. People's memory of Belhaven as being lily white just isn't accurate. There were the Skakels, for example, had two African-American teenagers living in their home at that time that were, you know, precisely the age of all these other kids. They had a black live-in housekeeper. There are many other people in Greenwich who had people who were working for them, live-in people who were African-American. The two officers who first arrived on the site were both African-American. So they're... Tony Bryant was a frequent visitor to Greenwich. He had a girlfriend in Belhaven. And again, people don't remember that these days. So the memories, you know, the memories are of virtually every witness that I was able to interview.
The second question now, just to get going, which was that hasn't been considered credible.
Well, this case has never been vetted by a jury. You know, the police never questioned these witnesses. One of the suspects, Adolph Hasbrook's home is only a few blocks from Frank Gar's office in Bridgeport, and yet Frank Gar has never bothered to go down and interview Adolph Hasbrook. Now, what the state will say now is, well, they've taken the Fifth. They refuse to talk to us. But the state has it in its power to give them immunity and force them to talk. And Tony Bryant has indicated that that's what he wants to do. He wants to tell the state the truth about this crime, but they won't give him immunity first, which, of course, they ought to. And if the state really believed that Michael Skakel was guilty, then why wouldn't they give immunity to these
three men? Yeah, but if they do, you're right, in that sense. But if they give them immunity and they're the real murderers, they're off.
Right, but if and I think that the state recognized that, and that's why they don't want to give them immunity.
All right, let's go back to some of these evidence, because to me, a huge, crucial moment is, did Michael go to the backcountry? Because that gives him an alibi. There is evidence that he did not. One of the things that's interesting is Julie Skakel in 1975, which is when this happened, you talk about memory problems, she sees that shadow at 9:30 that you talk about, and then she yells, "Michael, come back here." Finally, in the actual trial, as you say, she said she saw at 9:50 then large, dark, bigger figures than her brother running, carrying an object in their left hand. In 1975, she said at 9:50 she saw nothing. Did she change her testimony, or what are you basing that on, the confidence of Julie, who, and by the way, interestingly enough, Andrea Shakespeare, you say that she cited, and she very strongly, that Michael didn't went, and you go after her, but you never mentioned Julie had at one time said he didn't go.
I have never read anywhere that Julie said that he didn't go. Andrea Shakespeare says, and Julie says, what Julie has said consistently is she was in the house, that they never saw the Lincoln leave with the boys in it. Andrea Shakespeare never saw the Lincoln leave with the boys in it.
So they didn't know if Michael was in the car?
They were essentially in a dead zone in that house. And Andrea Shakespeare, if you read her testimony, she said Michael was never a suspect in this case, so nobody ever asked her about Michael Skakel until 10 or 15 years after the crime was committed. And she said at that time that she never saw Michael Skakel in the house, but that she had a feeling he was there. She also said she had a feeling about a bunch of other things. For example, that Jeffrey Byrne wasn't there. That were also inaccurate. And, you know, a hunch by a witness 15 years after the crime was committed is not very reliable evidence. Julie saw a figure just before she left the house. Julie and Andrea dashing in front of the window. It was in a crouched position. She didn't know who it was or whether it was one of her brothers, and she shouted out Michael's name, but she never saw him, and she does not believe that that was Michael Skakel.
Okay. I want to talk about the pants now. You know, these pants were seen in were recovered from the Skakel garbage, right? And these are the jeans. And that you say, and I've seen a picture of them, the waist does look way too big for Michael, but the length is pretty short. And I guess Michael denied they were his, but it was tracked down that they came from a camper in New Hampshire or something. And Michael did have them. They had some of his stuff in the pocket. You put them on Hasbrook, I think, right? Or you imply. But your book also says that Michael admitted they were his at one point.
Now, this is a, Jim, this is a big source of confusion in this case. There were actually two sets of pants and two sets of sneakers. There was a pair of pants that were shown to Helen Hicks by the police, by Carolyn Looney, the night after the murder, that were covered with blood, and a pair of I believe they were kid sneakers. So they were sneakers that the kids in Greenwich were not wearing. The kids in Greenwich were wearing tree-torn sneakers, which were sold at the Bellhaven Club and were regarded as cool by those kids. There was those pants and those sneakers, the size 13 sneakers and the size 36 pants, were lost by police afterwards. They appeared to be soaked in blood. A week after the murder, there was a pair of pants found in the garbage. And another pair of tree-torn sneakers. Those did belong to Michael Skakel. He never denied that those were his pants. They had a stain on them that turned out to be a paint stain. He had gotten them from a kid in New Hampshire. Tommy Sheridan told the police, in order to be a provocateur, that Michael had denied owning those pants or ever being at a camp in New Hampshire. Michael Skakel says Tommy Sheridan never talked to him about that and was doing what we showed Tommy Sheridan was doing throughout this book, which was to obfuscate and to tell lies to the police to cast doubt on Michael Skakel.
Hey, we're talking with Bobby Kennedy about the Moxley murders and his claim that Michael Skakel was framed. We'll talk about that coming right up.
Are you struggling with addiction or alcohol problems? If you're depressed, drinking, and using drugs, you may need help. And the Affordable Care Act guarantees coverage of substance abuse.
I knew I could get myself out of this. I just needed some hope and some help.
I took the first step to recovery when I made the call.
Call the Addiction Hope and Helpline now for a free assessment with someone who cares. Call 800-547-6533. 800-547-6533.
I feel like I'm losing control. I'm afraid I'll lose my job or even my family.
Call now for hope and help with proven, gentle recovery programs.
I never thought that I could be somebody who didn't drink and use drugs.
I'm in recovery, getting the help I need.
Call the Addiction Hope and Helpline now for a free assessment with someone who cares. Call 800-547-6533. 800-547-6533. 800-547-6533.
Say hello to John. John dreamed of building a successful business and retiring to an exotic island in the Caribbean. He dreamed about his sales soaring and all the money that would be flowing in. He dreamed of hiring a sales team and expanding his company. Well, sadly, that dream fell apart when his bank turned down his business loan. Now John is not dreaming about going to the Caribbean anymore. He's driving around in an old beat-up pickup truck. If you need money to grow your business to new heights so you can reach your dreams, don't let the bank hold you down. You need to call Merchant Advance Express today. We can help you get qualified for up to $250,000 to grow your business any way you want. Call now to learn more. Call 800-503-3735. 800-503-3735. 800-503-3735. That's 800-503-3735.
Hi, I'm Joan London. If you're worried about your parent or loved one living alone, like I was, and you want reliable senior care information, then call A Place for Mom, the nation's largest senior living referral service.
Finding an apartment that was on the courtyard with the view of the trees, the view of the ducks, the stream, the creek, all of that, that was what I needed.
You'll get free information on assisted living, Alzheimer's care, nursing homes, even important financial information. Here's the number.
To speak with a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-451-2976. That's 800-451-2976.
A Place for Mom is a free service, and you can trust them to help you. So if you're struggling to find reliable senior living information, there's a place for answers, A Place for Mom.
To speak with a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-451-2976. That's 800-451-2976.
Due to an upturn in the economy, Main Street Business Loans has pre-approved the release of millions of dollars in small business funding. Your business may already be pre-approved to receive up to $250,000. We've sent out millions of pre-approval letters. We see the economy growing, and our underwriters believe now is the time to invest in your business so you can grow faster and make more money. And we're prepared to give you up to $250,000 to do it. Your funds can be available in 5 days. There are no application fees, no annual fees, just quick access to up to $250,000. If your business did not receive your approval letter to get up to $250,000, call Main Street Business Loans Approval Desk now.
800-430-7570, 800-430-7570, 800-430-7570, that's 800-430-7570.
Has your life changed? Are you now in a situation where you need health insurance? Here's some simple advice. Call our health insurance hotline right now. This free service will do all the work for you. Shop the health insurance marketplace and find the plan that best meets your health insurance needs. Don't get lost searching for plans on your own. Let a licensed agent help you for free. According to a report on CNN Money, almost half of those eligible for subsidies are paying less than $3 a day for bronze or silver plans. Remember, under Obamacare, most Americans qualify for health insurance. So get ready to let us do all the work for you and find out the best health insurance plan for your needs. Call this number now.
800-659-7975. 800-659-7975. For your free health insurance quote, call now. 800-659-7975. 800-659-7975.
BizTalkRadio.com.
And we're back with Bobby Kennedy on his controversial new book, Framed. And we're going to ask him in a sec who did frame Michael Skakel. But I want to get to one more thing that, you know, whether there was a motive or not. And one of the things you say, it wasn't until 1998 that he knew Tommy and Martha had anything going on or that they were doing anything. I have a real hard time finding that to be credible. In the sense that there was, Martha's diary says that Michael was crazy about the thing.
About what?
In the car, they were right next to each other. Tommy was trying to feel her up. There's somebody named Liz Arnold from Elan, and I know you do a good job of discrediting Elan, who said that Tommy had stolen his girlfriend. Even in the car, if you have teen hormones, would you have said, oh, I'm going to go to the backcountry? You probably would have been pretty jealous.
First of all, Michael never read Martha Moxley's diaries. Michael is dyslexic. He, you know, at yes. that point in his life, he was reading nothing. And he didn't know until 1998 that there was anything between Tommy and Martha, even though Tommy had told that story to the Sutton detectives in 1993 or 1994. But Michael was never shown the Sutton report. And nobody talked to any of the Skakels about what was in the Sutton report because Tommy Sheridan wanted to keep the Sutton report secret because it illustrated that he was committing treacheries against the Skakels. Michael Skakel, an interest, as he said, he would have liked to kiss Martha Moxley, but he had two girlfriends, Jackie Wettenhall and another girl, Francie from Armonk, New York, whose last name I don't want to mention, but those were his girlfriends. He had, you know, he had a childhood crush on basically anybody, but Martha Moxley was his friend. To say that he didn't go to backcountry would mean that there were five people who've been lying over many, many years. That makes no sense.
Yeah, I don't believe in massive conspiracies. I find it hard to believe there's 15. Osorio also.
Well, there was eight at Bellhaven, eight people at Bellhaven.
Who were those people? Because some of them you said just you said Julie and Andrea were in the house and didn't see who left.
Right. So the eight people who stayed at home didn't see Michael at the house. Michael would have had to remain hidden for, 3 hours at the house with nobody seeing him.
All right. I want to talk now. The big surprise is this habeas corpus ruling on appeal that said that he got an incompetent defense, which I always thought had to be a level of you're drunk, you're sleeping, you know, really that kind of incompetence, not the quality of the defense. I asked Mickey Sherman, and his comment he gave me was from 1998 when the case began to 2004 when the verdict came in, Bobby stopped by for one day. Take us through the why you think Mickey Sherman blew the case.
Well, the vast inventory of incompetence and malfeasance and malpractice by Mickey Sherman is meticulously inventoried in the chapter on that subject in the book and in Judge Bishop's decision. So, you know, Mickey Sherman went to jail after this trial for essentially taking money that he was supposed to spend on the trial and spending it on personal enterprises and then failing to pay taxes on it. You know, I've taught trial practice for 30 years. I was a prosecutor. It just took a mighty effort to lose this case. I, in all of my years of teaching, I don't think I've ever met even a first-year law student who could have lost this case. This was a 30-year-old case where the police lost the murder weapon, they handled the golf club, they lost anal swabs, vaginal swabs that could have exculpated Michael, many, many hairs that were found on Martha's body. They lost the pants, the sneakers that were blood-covered. They made every mistake that you could possibly make. All of this stuff. Yeah, there are many other things. There were police in Rochester, New York, who were anxious to come to Greenwich to testify that Greg Coleman was a pathological liar who could not be believed on any account. People who knew Greg Coleman intimately, that was the key witness against Michael. Mickey never called them. So there were many, many other things that he did.
Did you feel all this while the trial was ongoing, that they made a mistake hiring him and or should he have been fired by Michael or whoever would have had that decision-making?
I was estranged from Michael during the trial. I called Mickey repeatedly to question judgments that I saw on TV. And, you know, he would assure me every time that I talked to him, I know what I'm doing. And people wonder if he was so incompetent, why didn't this case fire him? There's a number of answers to that. One is that the Skakel family, you know, Rush Skakel at that time was in the last throes of dementia, the father. So Michael was managing his own defense. What he says is, you know, when I get on an airplane, a 747, I just assume the pilot knows what he's doing. And Mickey had, as you know, this kind of boisterous confidence, and he also had a track record. He had actually tried a really difficult murder case, tried it on an extraordinarily imaginative defense, and carried it off. So, you know, you're talking about a dyslexic kid who has had a dysfunctional life, and has a highly recommended attorney that he immediately begins having doubts about, but he doesn't have the confidence to, or the knowledge of the law, or the knowledge to understand all of the crazy things that Mickey Sherman is doing. But as you'll see in my book, Michael is constantly badgering him to call witnesses, to correct misstatements by the prosecutor, and Mickey just never did it.
All right, let me give you one chance to. Mrs. Moxley never gets closure on this case. She's reading the book, I'm told, and she's heard about the Crawford Mills thing. He's the guy that you said first reported this to you. He ended up committing suicide. She had confronted him on he was working at ABC, I think. What about Mrs. Moxley on that?
The larger issue is I'm trying to give Mrs. Moxley and the Moxley family closure on this case. By putting the real killers in jail, I sympathize and empathize with Mrs. Moxley. I've had two members of my family murdered, and I know the difficulty of you losing people, you know, young people. I have two brothers who died at a very young age before their time or before they reached their potential. I have great sympathy for her, but it doesn't give closure to the Moxley family by putting an innocent man in jail for the murder of their daughter. It only compounds the tragedy. And I think, you know, ultimately, all of us have a duty to look for the truth. There's no justification for putting somebody who's innocent in jail. Mrs. Moxley has repeatedly said that she does not want to look at the evidence of this case. So her opinions about who is guilty and, you know, Michael's guilt come from Mark Furman, which she acknowledges, Detective Garr, Dominic Dunn, and Len Levitt. And those are all people with craven and mercenary agendas who, you know, I think did not do they did a great disservice to Mrs. Moxie, although they all claimed to have her interests at heart. I think all of them were pursuing their own interests, and I think I show that clearly in this book.
All right, thanks to Bobby Kennedy Jr. in studio giving us a full hour. The book is framed Why Michael Scapel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit, published by Sky Horse Publishing. Thanks, Charlie Lyons, for making this happen. Our next show, The Rise, Fall, and Comeback of Former New Jersey Governor James McGreevy. Thanks to Bobby Kennedy again for giving us a full hour. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see you next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Kamm.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com. BizTalkRadio.com.